horrible mistake. You shouldn't clap until you hear after what I say. It may be awful. Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you to the center and Professor Benvenisti for inviting me and for the kind hospitality. I have to say this particular privilege, last year we had the privilege at IU to host Mark, and he gave a tremendous lecture. It's also a privilege because our graduate, Earl Snyder, I think was really a visionary in understanding that in order to really have students understand changes in international law, it's important not only to teach the law, but also to engage in transnational exchanges in a way that really expands both our faculty and our students' minds. When it was created in 1997, this particular lecture with Ellie and with Fred Amon, who was the dean at IU at the time, I really think it was at the cutting edge of understanding how to expand the understanding of international law and international institutions. So what I thought I'd talk to you today, in part because I figured if I talked about U.S. law, you might not be able to ask me difficult questions, is trends that are occurring in the United States as it relates to cross-border litigation. And in the last 5 to 10 years, the United States Supreme Court has significantly curtailed the ability of foreign litigants to bring international or foreign claims in United States courts. That trend is fairly well understood. The general academic commentary in the United States reflecting on those changes and decisions have been one of a lament. The idea that the United States is yet again disengaging from international law and its institutions. Generally, there's a belief that the U.S. courts have become isolationist relative to other courts. And if not isolationist, then these decisions are evidence of a particular brand of American exceptionalism, of parochialism. I'm quoting from a few recent articles from young scholars that have been published in the Stanford Law Review that have sort of expressing concern more broadly about these changes. From those in the human rights and environmental rights communities, decisions like the Kyobel decision relating to human rights from a few years ago is viewed as essentially the United States gutting the only avenue for foreign litigants to being able to seek meaningful redress from human rights violations in certain places in the world. And if it's not that, then people are concerned that the United States court has adopted a particular brand of conservative activism that is not solicitous of court access, is anti-international, and generally is willing to close the U.S. court doors on these types of claims. I think that is wrong. I think that is an incorrect analysis of what the United States Supreme Court has done. And I think there is a more positive view to what has happened in the last couple of years. It's certainly true that courtroom access or court access in the United States to foreign litigants has been curtailed dramatically. But I do not think that that means that it is necessarily a negative for the development of international law and international institutions. In fact, I think just the opposite. I think rather the Supreme Court has rejected a particular brand of legal theory that has been advanced in the last 10 to 20 years. And it is a rejection of that particular theory of international law rather than international law and international institutions itself. The way I thought I'd lay out the lecture is I thought I'd start off by talking about the doctrinal developments, telling you about some recent Supreme Court decisions and what the holdings of those cases are. Then I thought I'd take a step back and talk about what I view as this sort of new legal orthodoxy, driven both by scholars on the left, liberal internationalists, and scholars on the right, sovereignists, neorealists, who've attempted to redefine and recreate international jurisdictional law in the United States from a particular theoretical viewpoint. And I'll explain what that is. And then I'll talk about how I think the U.S. Supreme Court's rejection of extraterritoriality in the domestic context may be actually more consistent with the development of international norms. And the question, I think, is whether American academics and American policymakers will take what's occurred on the cross-border litigation in a way that could lead to a development of more long-standing and long-lasting international norms or not. I'll hopefully do all that in 30 minutes or maybe not two, and then hopefully we have time for a good discussion. I should say at the start, I think very few people in the United States agrees with me on this, so if you disagree with me, I won't be offended either. Let me start off with some of the doctrinal developments in the United States. I really want to talk about three cases. The first was decided in 2010 which is the famous Morrison versus National Australia Bank. It's a securities case, but it is involving legislative jurisdiction, the ability of Congress to regulate or the courts to interpret regulations of Congress to overseas activity. In the United States, this was known as a triple cube case. I'll get to that in a second. The next one is the Kiobel versus Morrison case in 2013, Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum in 2013, which is the key alien tort statute case that essentially ended extraterritorial alien tort statute claims in the United States. That is, again, a legislative jurisdiction case. And then finally, I'll talk about Daimler versus Bowman, the most recent 2014 decision, which is an adjudicatory jurisdiction case, which significantly limits the ability to have adjudicatory personal jurisdiction over foreign defendants in the United States. So if I go through that, there's a number of other decisions in the foreign non-convenes areas. Sinochem was a well-known decision in 2007 that sort of expanded on the famous Piper versus Reno aircraft case. There are specific jurisdiction cases, Nicastro versus McIntyre being the most famous. There's the recent Foreign Sovereign Immunities case, the Sachs case, and then we have another extraterritoriality case in a RICO class context that is about to be decided by the Supreme Court. So there's lots of others I could have talked about, but I picked the three that I think have most dramatically had an impact. And in fact, of those three, it is probably the Daimler case, the general jurisdiction case, that has led to the most changes in the lower courts of kicking out and dismissing cases for lack of jurisdiction involving cross-border disputes. So let me start off by talking about Morrison and what that involved. This was a case that spurred out of the mortgage crisis in the United States. National Australia Bank had a Florida subsidiary that was basing their returns on a particular expectation of interest rate returns that were entirely false, arguably fraudulent. And when the mortgage and real estate market exploded in the United States, it had repercussions for shareholders of the common stock of National Australia Bank. And so they brought a claim in the United States arguing that 10b-5, the securities law in the United States, should apply to this overseas conduct. The Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision written by Scalia, disagreed on reasoning but agreed on the result, said that the United States Rule 10b-5 did not apply to these triple cube cases, cases where you had a foreign plaintiff suing a foreign defendant for a conduct and harm occurring in a foreign country. Here, to the Australian stock market, a company traded on a foreign exchange with Australian plaintiffs suing an Australian company. What was interesting in this case is that the majority with Scalia put an end to the so-called effects doctrine, which used to be a doctrine that said when a statute was silent in the United States, that you would presume potentially that Congress had intended to regulate the activity if there was a substantial effect or harm within the United States. The court rejected that theory and instead said that going forward, the presumption of extraterritoriality applied strongly to U.S. legislation as an interpretive method for the courts, that absent clear statements or clear indications in U.S. legislation that Congress intended the statute to apply to outside abroad activity, that a statute would only be read to cover activity within the United States. Now, there's lots of criticism as to whether the court got this right in this particular case. In fact, the whole case was based on activity of a Florida company, right, for harm that was occurring in the United States to the real estate market. But the case was clear, both by the conservatives and the liberals on the bench, unanimously, that that kind of case should not be heard in the United States court on the theory that the U.S. law did not apply to the foreign conduct. So that's number one. Morrison versus National Australia Bank sort of previewed things to come. And there was a lot of questions that perhaps Morrison was unique to the facts of its own case, that it was really a securities case that could be understood as sort of a narrow interpretation of 10b-5 and a concern by primarily the conservative justices on the court that securities litigation had become too broad. Any sense that Morrison was going to be limited, though, I think to the facts of the case went out the window with the Kiobel decision in 2013. Kiobel versus Royal Dutch was the famous Alien Tort Statute case, it raised a different question than Morrison, because in that case, you were dealing with arguably international law. And so one of the theories was that if you weren't dealing with a U.S. law, but rather you were dealing with a U.S. law that incorporated international legal norms, then in fact it would be universal and could apply without the presumption of extraterritoriality taking hold and preventing the court from applying that law to foreign conduct. In Kiobel, it was a unanimous decision by Chief Justice Roberts. And again, although there was disagreement on the reasoning, all justices agreed to the basic holding of the decision. Here's a picture of the plaintiffs in 2012. The general claim in Kiobel was that Shell and foreign European oil companies had essentially were complicit in human rights violations that were stopping environmental protests that were occurring in Nigeria at the time. And Kiobel again took the language of Morrison and said there was a strong presumption against extraterritoriality, and that presumption was not overcome in the language or the history of the Alien Tort Statute. And so the holding of the Supreme Court's decision in Kiobel was that the Alien Tort Statute, even though it was incorporating international norms, and regardless of whether it was incorporating universal international law norms, norms against torture and human rights violations, would only apply within the territory of the United States. And it was a complicated historical analysis or whatnot. But generally, again, it was rejecting the idea of extraterritorial regulation, and to some extent made an end to most Alien Tort Statute claims. It left open the possibility of bringing claims when the United States citizen is a defendant under a nationality principle. And yet the United States Supreme Court seems to be particularly reluctant to hear those cases anyway, or nobody seems to bring them. And so to a large extent, the promise of Alien Tort Statute litigation was gutted, at least according to many, by the Kiobel ruling. The third decision is Daimler versus Bauman, which was decided in 2014. This was a case, again, a human rights case dealing with allegations that Mercedes-Benz, their subsidiary in Argentina, was complicit with the Argentinian Dirty War from 1976 to 1983, and that Mercedes engaged in human rights violations and a number of terrible acts against progressive union and other employees at this Mercedes-Benz plant. The relatives of people who have been subjected to the torture brought a claim in California court. And the claim was to have the California court adjudicate the case based on the theory of agency, because Mercedes-Benz or Daimler had a very large Mercedes-Benz USA operation, of which a large amount of vehicles were sold each year into California. And the question then was there adjudicatory jurisdiction? Was there power by the U.S. court, the California court, over Daimler? And again, invoking concerns about extraterritorial regulation, the Supreme Court found that that there would be no jurisdiction in this particular case. And what they did is they limited general jurisdiction, what is known as all-purpose jurisdiction, in contrast to case-specific jurisdiction, to those actions where the corporate defendant is essentially at home in the forum. And the court then defined at home in the forum to be really limited to normally only two places. One is the company's place of incorporation, Daimler, Germany. Second one was their principal place of business, Daimler, again, Germany. They left open the possibility that there might be a narrow category of other cases where the contacts are so continuous, so substantial, and so systematic with the state that the company would be considered at home there. But it rejected the idea that had been previously adopted by many of the lower courts, that if you did a large amount of business in a particular state, then you were subject to jurisdiction there. Instead, what Daimler did is it created a relative question, which didn't say, is it convenient and reasonable for you to be subject to suit in a particular place because you've sold millions of dollars of cars there, but rather, is this your home? And so it was a relative question as to whether there was more contacts in California or more contacts in Germany. And of course, they found that Daimler's primary business was in Germany. That case has had dramatic effect, wiping out most transnational litigation in the United States, because unless the conduct occurs in the United States, you cannot base your jurisdiction on specific case-specific jurisdiction, and you need to go for all-purpose general jurisdiction, which makes it difficult to bring a claim. Those three cases acting in tandem, along with other cases, means that now it's increasingly to get difficult to get adjudicatory jurisdiction over a foreign defendant, and it is increasingly unlikely for the court to interpret the legislation, the state statute, or the congressional federal law to apply to overseas activity. And it's true that as a result of that, cross-border litigation is perhaps at an all-time low, and the promise of future cross-border litigation for activity not occurring in the United States, not occurring involving U.S. citizens as defendants, are unlikely to be successful. That builds on other cases in the area of foreign non-convenes, in foreign sovereign immunity, to make it very, very difficult to have a successful transboundary case in the United States. Okay, that's my overview. I know I just covered actually, in case you feel good about it, I just covered 12 weeks of course in 10 minutes. So I wanted to suggest that the reaction to that case, and as I say, I'm very much in agreement, it clearly is curtailed, but the reaction for why this has been problematic to some extent has to be understood as to legal theories that have developed in the last 10 to 20 years in the United States about the value of cross-border litigation and where source of authority for that cross-border litigation derives from. It is clear, I think, that in the international system, that extraterritoriality, at least historically, is counter to the foundational ideals of the international system, at least in most situations, because the notion of self-determination, territorial sovereignty, and equality of states. At least on the self-determination point, there is at least a sense of legal imperialism of one state imposing their law unilaterally rather than multilaterally upon another country. And maybe I should pause there to be very clear what I'm talking about here. I am not talking about situations where a U.S. court or any other court is applying their law by virtue of international agreement where there's been reciprocal court access. That's an entirely separate situation. I'm talking here only about unilateral exposition of American law, absent some sort of international agreement or sort of international framework. In 2011, in a well-known Harvard Law Review piece that sort of surveyed the field in the United States on extraterritoriality, although they were sympathetic to changes in doctrine, the general idea is that at least in its historic form, territorial sovereignty is a foundational prerequisite of the international state system, and that wide use of unilateral extraterritorial regulation is problematic. Against this backdrop, you can see how pressure from both what I would consider to be left-leaning liberal scholars in the international area in the United States and more right-leaning conservative scholars had led to both groups finding extraterritorial regulation through courts rather than through the executive branch or through the legislative branch as being attractive. On the left, there was a great thought that in the early 1990s, after the Cold War, that there would be a massive re-embrace of international law. And when that didn't happen, and when Congress was more a Republican Congress, there was a thought about how can we actually make advances in international law when we are stymied at the legislative and the executive branch levels. And the court system, which at the time was viewed as more liberal and more sensitive, or at least receptive to international claims, was viewed as a place to take the battle. And so a number of scholars, what they did is they took the theories that had been used in the U.S. civil rights context, using courts as an important weapon in the advancing of civil rights, and try to upload it into the international context. And so you see people like Harold Coe in his public transnational law litigation, which is essentially a tweak on the civil rights language of using public civil rights in the United States domestic law to advance domestic civil rights, and then trying to use that same strategy internationally. At the same time, another group of scholars on the left are taking descriptive claims of what's happening in the international system, the disaggregation of the nation state, the rise of non-state actors and their increasing importance in the international discourse, and taking those descriptive theories and turning them into normative theories. And so Anne-Marie Slaughter comes up with her disaggregated world order, and a number of scholars that are actually all mentees of Anne-Marie Slaughter start writing about international networks and how the nation state is falling apart. At the same time, anthropologists are describing the changes in the international system. And you have people like Paul Schiff Berman that take a descriptive theory from anthropology and social science and somehow come up with some normative pluralist theory that the world should be based on the disaggregated approach. That leads to all scholars on the left side of the United States for a very long period of time having to focus on these sort of, when you were looking at the hiring market as a dean, for a while you couldn't find somebody that didn't write about network theory. We were talking about this morning, you couldn't find an American scholar that would do black letter doctrinal international law analysis. It was all transnational law analysis. In fact, if you write an article today as a young scholar analyzing the law of the sea or some international convention from the United States, good luck on getting that published. So instead, there was this tremendous push on the left side to re-justify a particular brand of jurisdictional doctrine. And it basically ignored or turned away the idea of territorial restraints. Now, it came from a good place because territoriality was associated with lots of evils, right? It was commonly connected with the colonialism movement, human rights violations itself. And yet none of these theorists really sort of operationalized it on how it would actually work over the long term. It was very much a short-term strategy on how to win an individual case. At the same time, on the right, on the conservative side of things, a number of scholars sort of started pushing back on international law, believing that international law was a threat to American individualism and sovereignty, but frankly, more concerned that international law was being used by liberals domestically to win culture battle wars. And so you saw neo-realists and sovereignists come out attacking international law and institutions, the famous limits of international law. These are people like Goldsmith and Harvard and Bradley and Virginia and Eric Posner that basically said it's all self-interest and we're idiots if we sign on to international agreements. For them, although they disliked court proceedings, in part because of counter-majoritarian difficulties and federalism concerns that played out in domestic American politics, they were more comfortable fighting on that ground than they were fighting on the international development of international treaty agreements. And so they too were pushing against traditional international law through the form of treaties and customary international law, and were more content that the United States act unilaterally in its own self-interest through lawsuits. Again, I have taken maybe 20 different categories of legal theory, have pushed them all together and sort of oversimplified. But I do think it's true that for a long period of time, extraterritoriality was attempted to be re-envisioned by these scholars. So much so that actually arguing territorial theories made you either be viewed as sort of an idiot or somebody that was out of touch with the modern world. You could also view this from a different lens, not only from the way theory was developing through, as I say, sort of big names in the United States, such as Coe and Slaughter, but you could also see this happening through the uploading of domestic battles into the international arena. So one way of viewing this is that domestic fights were occurring at the sub-state level, and people were selectively choosing developments occurring in international law in order to buttress up their arguments domestically. And then the same thing was happening the other way around. Certainly you saw this in civil rights litigation, but then started borrowing again from international to support their positions. You saw this though also in tort reform, right? So in some of these cases, when you read the case, you're less convinced they're actually talking about international, and you're more convinced maybe that they just don't like litigation generally, that they're worried about unelected judges making policy-based determination, that they believe that plaintiff lawyers have run amok. This is the conservative approach, that there needs to be tort reform. And so sometimes it's hard to extricate from these decisions other battles that are occurring domestically, battles about the rules of judges, battles about separation of powers, battles about federalism that are occurring in these international cases, but are really about fights that are occurring in other areas in domestic law. This is partly the problem with American, I think, jurisprudence, is that often they're not telling you that they're talking about transnational litigation or cross-border litigation or international law. And often they don't even distinguish between the two. And so, for example, in personal jurisdiction, it is not entirely clear why the 14th Amendment constitutional due process protections apply to foreign defendants in the exact same way that they apply to domestic defendants. And yet it's a question that the U.S. Supreme Court has never addressed and doesn't even really consider in any of its opinions. The other big thing that's going on here is this big battle between legal realism, and post-legal realism, and legal formalism, battles between Scalia and Breyer on the one hand, as to how you interpret statutes generally. And you see that playing out in these cases a lot. Okay, again, covering very quick ground here. So my theory is that what the Supreme Court rejected was that particular brand of legal theory. Not actually what I think most Europeans would consider to be international law development. Certainly not a rejection of the idea that the United States should be bound by international legal principles. And in fact, I think that the foray into cross-border litigation, untethered from international agreement, is in the long term deeply problematic, both for those that are concerned, genuinely concerned about human rights and environmental rights development, and also for those from the sovereignist perspective that do not like international law. I think both those, the different theories, whether on the left side or the right side, are essentially short-term theories, but they're not long-term sustainable ways of moving forward either human rights or environmental rights or international law. Let me explain why I think that is and why I think the claim of most people right now, the conventional wisdom that these cases are anti-international and reflective of the dark ages in American jurisprudence is wrong, both as a descriptive matter and as a normative matter. So let me start with the descriptive one. Descriptively, I don't think you can read the United States Supreme Court cases and the three I described, or the other five or six that are dealing with transnational law, as really being anti-international. And the reason why I say that is because of the breadth of decisions or of the justices that signed on to the decision. So to be absolutely honest with you, if it was only Scalia writing it, I could understand why you people would be say this is a new era of litigation isolationism. But it's not. In fact, even those justices that many would view as very solicitous to international norms, people like Stevens and Breyer and Ginsburg, are also nervous about this broad assertion of unilateral American power. So if you look at the Breyer concurrence in the Kiobo case, adjudicating any such claim must, in my view, also be consistent with those notions of comity that lead each nation to respect the sovereign rights of other nations by limiting the reach of its own laws and their enforcement. Now, admittedly, this could be turned as a separation of powers issue, the more Roberts concern about foreign affairs, but I think not. I think Breyer actually has a particular view of international law that is just not consistent with the modern theories that have been advanced under Coe, Slaughter, and others. You look at his interpretation in Kiobo as to when he thinks jurisdiction should exist, and it's a classic articulation of international jurisdictional principles. I would find jurisdiction in the statute where the alleged tort occurs on American soil. That's non-controversial territorial jurisdiction. The defendant is an American nationality jurisdiction, or the defendant's contact substantially and adversely affects an important American national interest. That includes a distinct interest in preventing the United States from becoming a safe harbor, free of civil as well as criminal liability, for torture or other common enemy of mankind. And that was not the winning reasoning, right? It may be now with the changes on the court, as the court changes. But that also did not find that the Kiobo case was an appropriate case in the United States. But it leaves open a much broader range of cases that are still consistent with traditional international jurisdictional principles. In fact, citing to those traditional international jurisdictional principles of nationality, protective principle, and territorial sovereignty. Ginsburg does the same thing. In fact, in the Daimler versus Bowman case, at the very end, Ginsburg has several pages talking about international comity and being fairly critical of the Ninth Circuit of providing no concern about sovereignty issues in the decision. The Ninth Circuit paid little heed to the risk to international comity its expansive view of general jurisdiction posed. Other nations do not share the uninhibited approach to personal jurisdiction advanced by the Court of Appeals in this case. And in fact, it's interesting because it's almost ironic now that scholars are saying that the United States is an isolationist in its extraterritorial approach. Because for the last 70, 80 years, since the 1930s decisions in the antitrust context, most of the rest of the world has been deeply upset with the extraterritorial application of U.S. law. And in fact, oh, thank you. And in fact, it's only been recently that other countries have started to follow suit in broadly advancing their own law in an extraterritorial, unilateral way. In many cases, because they gave up trying to fight the United States on restraining their own law. And so if you look, for example, with Canada Foreign Affairs, they used to always sort of write briefs saying Canadian government has to be careful that it does not project its laws abroad because of traditional theories of self-determination and territorial sovereignty. Somewhere 5 to 10 years ago, they basically wrote something saying, we're never going to win this battle with the United States. We should go and do whatever we want as it relates to the U.S. because the costs are not that great as they once were anymore. You see that most poignantly in the so-called, it's a slightly different context, but the Canadian Cuban pajama crisis. This was the time where the United States enacted a law that said that anybody trading with Cuba was subject to criminal fines. They went after a Walmart that was selling Cuban pajamas in Canada. And so Canada then enacted a law saying that anybody complying with the United States law was subject to criminal penalties, which puts you in a bit of a bind if you're a company because you're subject to criminal penalties either way. That was very uncharacteristic, but it was essentially we've given up on trying to constrain. The UK was very much the same way. In a series of decisions and amicus briefs, or series of public statements and amicus briefs, very much opposed to broad assertions of extraterritorial power. And then more recently, that seems to have maybe softened, at least in some contexts. So I think it's odd now that the claim for why the United States is isolationist is because they've essentially maybe moved back to what every other country was doing in a few years ago, but for American sort of pushing the extraterritorial mantra. So my first point, at least, is that I think there's strong evidence that not all the justices were anti-international, but rather had a different vision of international law that still believed its territorial sovereignty to be one linchpin in that international system. My other point, though, is that normatively, the idea that we want to take domestic interest group politics and project it internationally is not a way that is going to be successful for human rights or environmental rights or for other things that you care about. I have no confidence that if extraterritorial litigation spreads throughout the world that we will see necessarily progress. I don't think it's linear, and I think it's highly as likely that courts will interpret their own laws in a way that is not supportive of human rights, at least as most in the human rights community envision them. The idea of a pluralistic system where every country decides for themselves what the international norm is as a way to bubble up to the international system is an incredibly dangerous way of creating international norms if you believe substantively that there are some things that are right and some things that are problematic. This is an incredibly sort of self-centered way, but to some extent, human rights activists and environmental rights activists in the United States would be much better off if they could exert their power through the federal government to use the power of the United States to obtain treaties that reflect their vision of human rights and environmental rights. That may not be good from a legal empiricist perspective. Presumably every country would do the same. But giving up on that approach and instead allowing the roll of the dice in individual countries seems particularly problematic. The pluralists themselves indicate in almost all their writings that they are no friends to human rights because they are ambivalent as to what the outcome is. And so it's unclear that a system where most of the work in international law is being done by courts rather than being done by legislatures or executive is a sustainable one. It's also problematic from those that are on the right perspective in the neorealists and sovereigntists. The idea that international law can be, you can inoculate a country from international law and be isolationist, at least from my perspective, is idiotic. The question is whether you're going to be part of the game or not. And for me, the sovereigntists, or the neorealists, if they believe that we should act in our self-interest, they're again much better off being at the table and acting in our self-interest in treaties and in negotiations rather than giving it up, in part because it's incredibly hard to control and monitor what's occurring in court systems throughout the world as being one of the ways to develop international norms. Given that sort of short critique, my sense is that hopefully this might be although I have worry here, this might be a way to re-engage American academia with the hard and difficult questions of international law, that is not built on just trying to save things like the Alien Tort Statute and cross-border litigation. Not that those couldn't be good as long as they were put in a framework somewhere where you have traditional consent and negotiation. And the reason for that is that I'm worried right now that many or most American academics are fighting old battles that are probably lost. And so most of the literature now is talking about how we could revitalize the Alien Tort Statute, where if you don't use that, could you bring these international claims in state courts in the United States, where perhaps you bring in claims for battery as a way to go after an international human rights claim. And to me, that misses the entire point. The idea that we're going to chase and find some local municipal judge that is going to side human rights violations, to me, seems odd. Instead, it'd be nice, I think, if American academics move further away from sort of trying to stave off what I think is an inevitable end of most of this cross-border litigation, instead figure out when it's really effective to use, and re-embrace a more robust role in the United States for negotiating meaningful treaty-based agreements that could, within those treaties, have a significant role for courts. I worry that if not, we were going to end up in a stalemate where we just spend another decade debating things that the court is not receptive to. And even with the changes in the court that's occurring, there's no indication that any members of the court have that wide perspective of universal jurisdiction or extraterritoriality where borders don't matter. In fact, it's just the opposite. Even the liberals on the court are quite concerned about what they view as legal imperialism of the United States projecting its laws abroad without any international agreement or legitimacy. I hope that was interesting. I covered a large area of ground in a very short period of time and tried to respond to a particular debate that's occurring in the United States, but then to set it up with some background for an audience that may not be as familiar with the U.S. cases, or at least I'm hoping that is. I'm happy to open it up to any questions you might have. I know I went quickly, and so if there's an area you'd like me to talk more about, I'd be happy to do that. Well, thank you.